morning and welcome to today's summary of our previous lectures. And we saw at the beginning of the lecture, basically in the start, how to quantize 3D gravity in the loop quantum gravity framework. We started by looking at the Einstein-Hilbert action, but you might ask why we consider 3D gravity, because we want to use it as a toy model to gain some intuition as to what to expect in the more physical 4D case. So in order to do this, we look at the Einstein-Hilbert action. We realize that the solutions admit solutions that are topological. They have no local degrees of freedom because the Ricci tensor completely determines the Riemann tensor. So it's vanishing means that you have flat solutions everywhere. You have no gravitational waves. This led us to the conclusion that it's a topological field theory that has no physical degrees of freedom. And that we went further by introducing, basically, so from this, we now knew that we are working with a topological field theory when we are dealing with 3D gravity. So we'll come back there. The Dirac program then was basically for, if you want to quantize a totally constrained system, how you go about it, you construct something like a kinematical Hilbert space. And then and then what you do next is you impose the constraints to get on this space to consider a subspace of this kinematical Hilbert space to get a more physical Hilbert space, and from that one you would have the quantum theory you're looking for. And that's the program we are coming to introduce in LQG for 3D gravity. First of all, to begin with, we consider the first order action. We introduce the frame field with the co-triad. And it's at all points on space-time, we have this additional structure, that is at this internal space. It's related to the metric through this formula. The first order action there, which depends, has the configuration variables, the trias and connection. Now, this is on the full 3D manifold. In order to implement the canonical quantization, we consider this topology of our manifold of sigma cos r, where sigma is a 2D hypersurface, which we are assuming to be orientable. And with this, the phase space was parameterized. Now, instead of considering the full 3D connection, we are considering the pullback of that connection on our hypersurface. And so our phase space is parameterized by this pullback of the 3D connection, and this is on the hypersurface and the densitized triad. Next, we realize that the equation of motion gives us constraints, the mere form of which are the Gauss and the curvature constraints, the flatness constraints. And that this algebra of constraints is that of semi-derived products of the translation and rotation. Then, in order to regularize this Poisson bracket, we don't use the full connection and densitized trias, but instead we use a discretized version of those, which gives us a phase space which is parameterized by the holonomies and the fluxes, which was defined in lecture. And the nice thing about these holonomies is that when you take the holonomy around the closed loop, from Gauss' theorem, we know that it contains all the gauge invariant information about the connection. And so all our observables of the theory, which we expect to be gauge invariant, are contained in these Wilson loops. And this is where the loop in loop quantum gravity comes from. And next, we proceeded to consider the algebra of these basic variables. And we found that they have that of a cotangent bundle of SU2. Then we went to quantization of an edge to find a representation of that algebra, where the holonomies acted as multiplicative operators and the fluxes acted as left invariant derivatives. Then next thing we did was to construct the length operators, the length operator in our theory. And the important conclusion we drew from there was that length is quantized. So you have a fundamental unit of length, which was the Planck length in 3D gravity at the quantum scale. And then next thing to do following the Dirac program is to So after this, you have now your states, which are Hilbert space, which are going to be square integrable functionals of this connection, which is just the kinematical Hilbert space. But in order to get the quantum theory, the physical states, we must impose the constraints. And remember that for the equation of motion, we have two constraints, right? We have the Gauss and then the flatness constraint. So we have to impose these on our Hilbert space to get a subspace of that Hilbert space, which is the physical Hilbert space, which are those states that satisfy these constraints. So we need to find a promote these operate these constraints into operators. And in order to do so, we realize that since these ones generate internal rotations, and we can define them using the transformation property of the holonomy, which is mainly that it transforms, you know, like a G, H, G inverse, where one G is on the target. You have like your H, and then you have an incoming node and an outgoing node. And so you have G on the target vertex, and then G inverse on the source vertex. So you can implement them basically like an adjoint action. Remember when you saw at the action of SO3 on SU2 by rotations, it's like an adjoint action of SU2 on itself, right? So we implement the Gauss constraints using that philosophy. We realize that the states that satisfy these constraints are the intertwiners, which project you from, for example, on a three edge state, on a node with, so on a trivalent node, we realize that this intertwiner takes you from the three representations, J1, J2, J3, to an invariant subspace, which is invariant under the action of SU2, which are these intertwiners. So great, so these are the gauge invariant states of our theory, but we are not done yet. There's one more constraint you need to impose to be able to then have our physical Hilbert space, and that is the flatness constraint. By observing that taking the holonomy around the closed loop, it encodes information about the curvature of the surface that's enclosed in the loop. We can implement the flatness constraint by letting certain F to be zero, and that is just setting this holonomy to be the identity. And so in order to get an idea of what we are doing, we considered a concrete example where our 2D hypersurface was a two-sphere. And we have this tetrahedral network defined on that two-sphere, and we impose the Gauss constraint by setting these holonomies around closed loops on these faces of the tetrahedra to one. And you might argue that there are four faces, so why are we doing just three? We realize that there's a redundancy in the information and it's sufficient to do three. And when we try to now we have our physical states, we had an issue defining the inner product because it was giving us infinity, because these states that satisfy the flatness constraints are not normalizable. In order to find a well-defined physical inner product, we defined this transition amplitude, and we found out that it factorizes, which means that our physical Hilbert space is in fact one-dimensional. And so for our theory on the two-sphere, we have a one-dimensional physical Hilbert space, and furthermore, in the reduced phase space, it's zero-dimensional. And this means that in the 3D case, we've now successfully executed our Dirac program. And why do we think this Dirac program works? We saw that for the case of a parameterized particle, you can go from quantum classical mechanics of that particle to just quantum mechanics of the particle by imposing the constraint to give us the Schrödinger equation. And so we believe indeed we have found a 3D quantum theory of gravity using this program. And that's what it did. Thank you.
All
right.
Thanks.
Okay.
Talking about Okay, so we started talking about Malkuchian 40 via the ADM formulation. So the idea was we started with the Einstein-Hilbert action, and we split space-time up into a product of a three-manifold cross time, and the phase space variables. So you have a spatial metric, and it's conjugate momenta, which roughly describes the extrinsic curvature of this three-manifold. Okay, and the idea behind the ADM is that we can change variables such that a theory living on N3 is topological SU2 gauge theory. So. Is it not? Have you just okay? Yeah. Okay. So then the phase space variables were So here, this is the extrinsic curvature. And then this is an extra parameter called the Barbaro-Lemerenzi parameter. And we can compute the constraint out. We can introduce like some constraints. So you have the Gauss constraint and a diffeomorphism constraint, and which is a vector constraint, and then we have a scalar constraint, and we can introduce some string constraints and compute the constraint algebra, and something weird happens in that it doesn't exactly close. One of the brackets is like pretty complicated, so that's a thing, and then we can apply the usual Dirac quantization program, and okay. So introducing the kinematical Hilbert space is pretty similar to what happened in 3D. So the states in here will be these cylindrical functions. which depend on the connections only through their holonomies. Then we have a measure on the Silbert space that's built out of the R measures. And then we work with like a completed version of this with respect to this measure. And I guess the only new feature is that we also, in addition to the area operators that we had in 2D, we also have like some volume operators here and imposing the constraints in the quantum theories. Yep. Yeah.
So you're good?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so also the difference is that here, of course, so you didn't write, you wrote explicitly what was the constraint, so we know to impose the Gauss constraint and this vectorial constraint, but not this, of course, this scalar constraint is still missing. And so now what I'm going to talk about, it's really the spin foam approach, which was motivated by the need to shed light on this issue of dynamics of loop quantum gravity. So by attempting, so what is the spin foam approach is try to construct a path integral representation of the theory, okay? So you can really see, so let's start here. So the spin foam were really introduced as the path integral representation. This was the motivation, and then it has been developed on its own. And in fact, now to make really the link between, at least in 4D, in 3D, everything is, we have the equivalence between the spin foam model and the loop quantum gravity model that we have seen. Okay, so we know really how to make the link between them, but in 4D, in fact, it's not so obvious. We have some proposition of model of spin foam, and it's not so obvious how it's related to the loop quantum gravity approach, okay? So this was initially the motivation. So formally, we would like to write something, so this is very formal. So we start from 3D or 2D surface, depending on if you're in 2D or 3D, initial to final, and you want to find the probability of transition here. So it's going to be written like something like this. So if you will use the first order formulation, we have a triad or tetrad and a connection, and then we need to find a measure. And we have the exponential of the action of GR. Okay, so the idea is to give a sense to that, which defines, so the probability of transition between a final state, a final initial geometry, so this will be your initial geometry and a final geometry, okay? And so the proposition, the spin foam approach, were first introduced by, so to try to give a sense to that, and by Eisenberger and Rovelli, Carlo Rovelli, Michael Eisenberger and Carlo Rovelli in 97. So what is the idea here? Is that if we work in the spin work basis, we want to express, so if S and S prime are two spin work basis, we would like to have the physical, of course this is missing, but we would like to have this physical inner product, and this can be the idea of the spin foam model, is that this can be expressed as a sum over spin network history. Thank you. So what is the picture here? So this, the idea would be you start from a given 2D surface or 3D surface with some graph, okay? And you're going to make that evolve in time to go to, and then get a final state here, okay? And so what you have here is what we call a spin foam. So here it's your initial state describing your initial geometry, your finite state describing your geometry. Then you have a transition amplitude, okay, with which is given by this sum over spin network histories. And this is what we call just a spin foam, which is a colored two complex. So what is a two complex? A two complex is a set of elements called, so you have vertices, edges, and now faces, because it's one dimension higher. And of course, you have some boundary relation between them. So you know that the edge is going to be bounded by two vertices, a face is going to be bounded by some edges. And this is what we call the two complex. And now it's a colored one. So what does it mean? This means that you remember that when you start from your spin network here, it's also a colored graph. So this means that each of these vertices here on these two surfaces is, or three surfaces, depending on your dimension, is decorated by an intertwiner, and each of these edges is decorated by a spin representation. And so now you make this evolve. So this means that this intertwiner is going to be, so of course my drawing is not complete, but it's going to evolve like this. So this means that here on edges, on in the bulk, what you're expecting for your colored two complex is that edges now are going to carry intertwiner representation, and faces are going to be colored by spin representation. Okay, so what is the color here is an irreducible nearreps of your gauge group. So let's call G. In 3D is going to be SU2, but in 4D is going to be, if you're Euclidean, is going to be SO4. If it's Lorentzian, is going to be SL2C or SO31. So to each face here, and you have an intertwiner to each edge now of your two complex. Okay, so this is the kind of the idea of what we want to define and the kind of object we are going to work with. So now how concretely we are going to do that. So you remember that the Hilbert space of quantum geometry states of loop quantum gravity, so H, where we already take into account at least the Gauss constraint, but we can also take the special DFEO, is spanned by spin network state, where S is given by a graph. And then SU2 representation on the link, and intertwiner on the node.
This is the kinematic of the space?
Yeah.
Okay.
So this is the starting point, because it's only what we have access to. Okay. We don't know, if we knew already the physical, of course we can still, it's still interesting to have a kind of checking by having another approach, a path integral approach, meaning what would be great, it would be to have both complete story, meaning the path integral approach and the Dirac program. But now, since we are just stuck at the kinematical level for the Dirac program, we try to implement the dynamic. So this is the starting point from loop quantum gravity. Okay, and so now we are going to consider a 4D region of our manifold with a 3D boundary, like I call sigma. And the spin network state is going to define the quantum state of the geometry of this boundary. So this is can use that to define the quantum state of geometry of the boundary. And it's the boundary of, this is the boundary of a 4D region, or 3D if we are in 3D, but. And then, so if we consider that, then we're expecting that the spin foam amplitudes are going to define the dynamics. So the dynamical probability amplitude, so of that state on the boundary, and re-encode the whole quantum gravity dynamical content. Quantum gravity, but dynamical . So what is now the ansatz which has been made? So this is, so contrary to really the Dirac approach, the loop quantum gravity approach, everything is really well defined, and at the mathematical level, everything is really robust. Okay, there's been really well, everything has been checked, well defined at the mathematical level. The spin foam approach is a bit more mixing different ideas, and even at the mathematical level, not everything has been checked. And the way, so we're going to be in 3D, we can define the model, and we are going to recover, since we have the loop quantum gravity approach to compare, it's nice because then we can check that what we did is correct. But since it's a topological theory, we're going to see that, in fact, any topological theory can be written in terms of spin foam amplitude very easily. And then the point is going to go to 4D, and then in 4D, yeah, there are many different approaches, and it's not very clear if we have the right one, okay? So what is the standard ansatz here? So we make the ansatz that we are going to talk about local spin foam amplitude, meaning that you're going to see what does it mean. So we're going to have an object like this. So it's going to be a sum over all two complex, where the two complex, the boundary of the two complex is given by the graph of this spin network, okay? Such as this is given by the graph associated to this spin network S. And here we're going to have some statical weight that is going to be defined later on. And then we're going to sum them all irreducible representation, all intertwiner, so irreducible representation associated to the faces, and intertwiner associated to the edge. And then we have a product of amplitude associated to the face, where I'm saying it's local, means that this amplitude is just, if it's the amplitude to a given face, is just going to depend on the irreducible representation associated to this face, and then you take the product of all the faces here, then you have a product of all the edges with some amplitude associated to these edges. And here, this is just going to depend on the faces, so you have an edges, so you have, it's going to separate some faces, so you have here the irreducible representation of these faces and the intertwiner associated to the edges. And then at each vertex, we're going to have amplitude associated to this vertex. So this is really formal, and I'm going to show you explicitly how we get that in the 3D case. But so most of the time in 4D, and yeah, what is important is that all the dynamical information is encoded in this amplitude vertex here. So all this is is encoded in the vertex amplitude. And so, for example, in the 4D case, we usually really focus on this object. And so many discussions have been done on also the importance of this other amplitudes, which are often forgotten. Okay, so again, to tell you that, at least from my point of view, the spin form approach is still really under discussion. Okay, everything I presented in the loop quantum gravity approach is really robust. In the spin form approach, there are still many discussions. And of course, this kind of amplitude can be more or less derived directly from, can be seen as the regularization of the covariant path integral. Okay, so if we start, and it's what we are going to do in the 3D case. Okay, so let's start from the action of 3D gravity again. So what time? Okay. And try to derive this spin form amplitude. So 3D case is going to be the Ponzano.
Well, can you say by the regularization of path integral?
Sorry?
You said by the regularization of the path integral?
So in fact, we are going to see that to regularize this means that we are going to quantize everything. So first, we are going to start with our manifold. We are going to triangulate this manifold. In particular, in 3D, we can just look at a simple triangulation since everything is topological. It's going to be, we don't even need then to sum over all everything. And then we are going to discretize the variable on this triangulation. So contrary to the loop quantum gravity approach where the discrete aspect really come from the geometric operator. Sorry, here we really use that as a regularization, but it's also motivated by the result we have from the loop quantum gravity approach because we want to relate that. Okay, so the starting point is again our action, the first order action. So here I'm going to rewrite this in terms of this spin connection, and I'm sorry, but I change again notation. So and as we said, this is a kind of BF theory, if you call this E field a BF theory. So the BF theory are really a general case of invariant topological theory. Okay. And so the formal path integral for 3D is for 3D gravity is just so we integrate over, and so we are going to try to kind of regularize this kind of path integral and get what we call the spin form amplitude. Okay. So the first step is, so we start with M, and we're going to consider just that this can be triangulated, so it's a simplicial. We can replace that with a simplicial manifold with a similar topology. And then the first step, and this is okay because in 3D everything is topological. So the first step, so we are not going to lose any information here, is going to be the discretization and so this means here that in fact we have a triangulation which is obtained by gluing tetrahedra together. And what is important here is to look at the triangulation and the dual triangulation. So this is what I call the triangulation. We're going to need both. Sorry. Maybe I should. And here it's what we're going to call the dual graph. So here we are going to get everything by gluing tetrahedron together. So this is our triangulation of our space-time, which is 3D. And what is going to be the dual graph? To each tetrahedron, I'm going to have a vertex. Okay, so here it's a tetrahedron. And then this is going to be a vertex. Then to each face, do you see what is going to be the dual to each face?
It's an edge.
Yeah. Okay, so I'm going to have an edge. So I don't know if I'm going to represent that very well here. And I'm missing the last one. Okay, so this is the dual graph. So here it's edge. And then to here, if I call each of these objects a segment, what is going to be the dual object?
Sorry, what?
So here it's a triangle even. We can be more specific because we are talking about tetrahedron, okay? So then what is going to be dual to this each of these segments?
I guess.
What did you say?
No, the dual of the, this edge.
Yeah, so of this segment, what is dual to that? So you see that we have, the picture is going to have many, then you have tetrahedron glued together. Okay, so this edge is going to be the segment. This segment is going to be the segment of several tetrahedron, and each of the faces of the tetrahedron are going to be dual to an edge. So here, in fact, you can close, and we get a face. Okay. And then here, the point of your triangulation. So the white one is the triangulation. Then it's what we are going. What is going to be our spin network state? The point is going to be just a 3D region here. Okay, you cannot really say what is going to be the shape of this. Okay, so this is what we did. The first step is to discretize using a triangulation of the manifold, and then we need to discretize the variable. And of course, here we're going to use what we have seen from the loop. Is so now I'm going to define from E, I'm going to define this object, which is not really the flux because you don't have the holonomies here. It's just the integration over the edge of the triangulation. Okay, so E here is the edge of the triangulation. So maybe it's going to be a bit confusing with this notation. And then the spin connection is going to be built as an holonomy for the edge of the dual. Okay, really the dual is going to be what is going to be the spin network in loop. So here we have, and this is an element, can be seen as an element of the Lie algebra of SU2, and this is then just the holonomies, so you know that this is an element of the group. And of course, if you look now at, because we need this object here, the curvature of the connection, so F of omega is going to be given by the product of the different holonomies. It's going to be discretized as a product of, and here you have a sign depending on the orientation of your edges. Okay, and this is all, so what does it mean here? And this is also a SU2 group element. Okay, so as I told you, E here is dual to a face, okay, in the dual graph. And all these holonomies here are defined on this purple edge. Okay, so what is now the holonomy U of E? This means that you consider the face dual to this edge E. Okay, so here what you have is really the product of all these SU2 group elements associated to these purple edges. Okay, and of course here you have plus or minus the inverse or not, depending on the orientation of your, everything has to be oriented again. Okay, so if you have something like this, let's say that here it's going to be G, and then here it's going to be the inverse because you have another, depending on your
orientation. Sorry, under the product, it's E-dual?
Yeah, E-dual, which is like included in, meaning it's related to this E, okay? So it really means that you take this, the, in fact, what this is, it's just because I don't want to introduce too many objects, because you see that since we have the triangulation and the dual, you could give a notation for all these objects. But here, what I have chosen is to call this segment E, and this edge is E star. And you can always talk about the face. And here, this, of course, is related to a face of the dual graph, but the face is in one-to-one correspondence with one. Okay, yeah. You have really a one-to-one correspondence between the dual and the triangulation. So you can choose just a notation in one of them. And then this is going, for example, this edge is going to determine the triangle of the triangulation. Okay, so now this, after this triangulation, let's see how this action, how the action on the triangulation is going to read. Okay, nice. I still have a blackboard. So then, triangulation, the action on the triangulation reads, so just, so now it's defined in terms of this element, and it's just going to be in the infinite integral. Now we have a sum of all the edges of the triangulation of this object. And now the discrete path integral is so you see that here the regularization will really introduce by hand a discrete, we discretize everything. It's going to be, so it's associated to the, our given triangulation. We are going to take the integral for each edge of the triangulation. We have this integration over the, so here it's the Lie algebra, but in fact we can just use the Lebesgue measure on SU2 seen as the R3, okay, which is what we're doing here. And so, yeah, we need this integration. Then we have the integration over all dual edges of the dual triangulation, where now it's over SU2, and here it's the usual, it's a Haar measure that you are familiar with now, and then we have this exponential of E of this discrete action. Okay, so what can we now? In fact, here we can integrate over the x variable. And so the first step is going to do the integration over the x and use the fact that, because here you have an exponential of e trace of where you integrate over, so let's say R3, and this is a delta function. And now using the Peter Weiss theorem, that you have seen. In fact, this can be decomposed over the group, the matrix representation of, and you still have a trace, sorry. Where DG here is, again, the dimension of your representation. OK, so here I use the Peter-Weyl theorem. And here, in fact, there is a small subtlety, is that this delta is, in fact, the delta over SO3 and not SU2. If you, this delta of, over SU3 is, in fact, the sum of a delta of SU2, seen as SU2, of U plus with minus U, OK? You can have both. If you see that, but, and then this means because, so what does it mean? It means then in the, because it's what appears in the Planck-Schnell decomposition, and so this means that here, instead of summing over all spin alpha representation, in fact, we are just summing over integer, okay? So it's, because for SO3, you just have the integer. So this is a small subtlety that you can modify if you add the other term, but I'm not going to do it now, okay? Okay, so what do we get now? And you should find something you're familiar with. In fact, what is going to appear is again this 3J symbol, and then of course the 6J symbol. Okay, so this means that this can be written as now a sum over all representation, this product, so we still have this integration over this SU2. And this product over, well, the triangulation, where we have now the trace and so this is now the a bit the tricky part. So again, if I go back to this, yeah, let's go back to this drawing. So let's consider, for example, this edge here. Each edge here, in fact, is going to be bounded by, so if you really glue everything together, you need to look, so each edge is going to be bounded by three dual faces, okay? Because, so if you glue everything, so you're going to have one here, then one around this. Yeah, so let's start again. So you see that this E, E star, is dual to this triangle, okay? So this means that and a triangle has three edges. So this means that here you're going to have three different faces of the dual graph, okay? Because one going around these edges, one going around these edges, and one going around these edges. Mm-hmm. Okay, so this means that here, when you write everything with all this product, each G, okay, is going to appear three times, because since we have a triangulation. Okay, so you have one coming from this, around this edge, and around this edge, okay? So this means that now, and because here what you have is that this trace of this is in fact a trace of, and then you have a product of, and you will have three objects with this, okay? So here now, this means that for each, you get an integral of the form. And this should be familiar. You integrate over. And these G1, G2, G3 are the one associated to these edges here. Okay? So you have something like this. With, of course, magnetic number, because you need to develop this product, M3, M3. And you remember that this is exactly what we define as the 3G symbol, up to some sign. So I think there is a sign. And then I have the product of these two 6G symbols. 3G symbol, sorry. One with the N. And so these are what we call intertwiners. And this intertwiner, since it's for each E dual, okay? This means that to each face of your triangle here, so you have four faces, and on each face of your triangle, now you have intertwiners. Okay. And so when they are glued together into one spin network, which is going to define the quantum state on the boundary of your spin network, of your tetrahedron, okay? So here, now, let's maybe do this small drawing. Yeah, so this means that now on your triangle, you, if you want, what we did is we integrate over SU2. Here we had the G element, okay, where we had 3 on this face. And this now can be is equal, in fact, as here you have 2 intertwiner with these 3. So if you want, it's E and the I and I dual. And so now if we closed the spin network around this, of the boundary of this tetrahedron, which is going to be again a tetrahedron, this means we want to glue together 4 intertwiner. And this is exactly the same thing that we did when we use the flatness constraint. Okay.
Where are the planners on the face?
Yeah, on the face of the triangulation. And the triangulation is dual to a spin network. And if now you look at this, so yeah, here what you have to look at is the spin network on, so it's not the same duality as here. This is a bit the tricky thing. Is if you want to build the spin network on the boundary of this tetrahedron. And this is, again, a tetrahedron. And so this means that what you want to do is really, because here my drawing is not really well done, you want to, these 3 edges are, in fact, going to be dual to the 3 edges here. Okay, so if you want, you more have something like this. And you have this on all faces of, so this edge are dual to this edge is dual to this edge. And now you glue all these intertwiner together. Okay. Because they are all contracted if you take the trace and everything. And so at the end, what you get is you want to combine 4 intertwiner together corresponding to these 4 triangles. And then it's the 6G symbol that you get. Okay. So here, by combining the 4 3G symbol corresponding to these 4 triangles, then we get a ici que j'ai. OK, so I don't know what time. Yeah, so I let you get convinced of that. Maybe I could do the drawing. And so what we get at the end, I'm just going to give you the result, and then I just want to explain what we're doing in 4D quickly. So the Ponzano-Reggie amplitude, here is for a given color triangulation is simply given by the product of the sigg j symbol. So here, if you finish completely the calculation, what we get is, so we have some factor, again, the dimension, and then take the product of all tetrahedron, and you get associated to each tetrahedron, you get a sigg j. And we're here, usually it can be also seen as a normalized, if you have exactly this formula, if here you normalize this sigg j. And so why do we say that this is, because you see that we are very far from the beginning. We introduced some regularization, so how do we check that indeed you are talking about gravity here? So here, if you look now at the limit, semi-classical limit of this sigg j symbol, meaning you look, in fact, here you can reintroduce the h bar into the game, or it's like looking at when j, if j is related to the length of the quantum length of an edge, this means that if you want to go to the non-quantum, you want to go to large j. Okay, so you take j is to infinity, and what you get is something like this, where we have the cosine of this red j action. And the red j action is, so have you heard already about the red j action? Red j calculus? Yes. So the red j action is really a discrete version, so not quantum version, but just discrete version of the action for general relativity, okay? So this means that here, of course, we still keep the discreteness, but at the same, it's not quantum anymore, and we really recover the description of discrete general relativity here. Can you read or? And then it's a volume term of zero tetrahedron here, I'm sure. Okay, so just maybe in 2 minutes, or maybe I'm not going to write anything, but I can just tell you what is the idea with 4D. Okay, so you see that here we can do everything because it's a topological theory. So the idea of 4D gravity is really to reformulate 4D gravity as a BF theory, plus, of course, some constraints which are going to reintroduce the geometrical degrees of freedom. And so this means that we start with what is called the Plebonsky action here. And now this Plebonsky action is the gauge symmetry is SO31 or SO4, depending if you look at Lorentzian or Euclidean. And so if you look at the constraint, the issue with the constraint, so it's what we call the simplicity constraint. And the issue with the constraint is that these constraints are second class. Okay, so you remember the definition of the second class constraint. And so what is the idea of the spin foam approach in 4D is really, so you start from what we know. So what we know is the topological theory. So we start with the BF action, and we quantize that. So we know to quantize that. And then the idea is to try to implement the constraint at the quantum level. And since they are second class, this is a bit tricky. So there are several propositions. The last one, the most studied, is what is called the EPRL model. So EPRL is for Engel, Pereira, and Rovelli, okay? So, and Yeah, so maybe I can, what I'm going to do, since I don't really have time, is I'm going to post some references on your wiki page or send them by email if you want to have a look. But so this is really the idea, is to, we know to do when it's topological, so let's rewrite 4D gravity as a topological theory plus constraint. We know how to quantize the topological part, so we do that, and then let's try to understand how we can implement the constraint. And so there are many discussions on the way the constraint has been implemented. So first model was the Barrett-Crane model, and it's, of course, it was two constraints because all the constraint was implemented what we call strongly, so as a strong equation. And then the result was that there was only a unique intertwiner. So there was no degrees of freedom, of course, because there was a unique intertwiner. So now with the other approaches, they try to implement the constraint weakly, so more as in a weak sense. And now the idea is which calculation can we do with these models to try to say something and try to, of course, at some point do some prediction or something like this. Can we compute some transition amplitude which have physical meaning? What can we say then, etc. Okay, so I think I'm going to finish here.